You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And beautiful day today. Thank yes, you very
it
much.
Is. Yes, it is. So, Caroline, tell us who we have. We actually have two guests today.
Yes.
And so tell us who's up first.
The first one is a gentleman by the name of Deepak Singh, and he is from India. He is a writer, radio producer, and journalist. He's a frequent contributor to Public Radio International's The World and has written for the New York Times, National Public Radio, the Boston Globe, and the Atlantic. And his book is entitled, How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. And it's a very good book, let me tell you.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Deepak.
Thank you very much for having me, Monica.
So why don't you just give us a kind of a brief synopsis of the story in How May I Help You?
Yeah, so I grew up in India, in a town called Lucknow, 4 million people, and I got an MBA because my parents wanted me to get a degree that gets me the job. So I got that degree, but I didn't like MBA kind of job. So I just taught, just did art jobs for a while. And then one day I met a producer from BBC World Service who offered me a job to produce radio shows. And he wanted me to train on the job. So I took the job and I became a radio producer. And I came to the States. I met a woman in my hometown. I fell in love with her. And she's from rural Pennsylvania. Her name is Holly. And we got married. I came to the States. And I thought I would be able to find a job with my degree and MBA and my BBC World Service experience and my good English, my good education. But that didn't happen. So I took a job in retail to make ends meet, to make some money. And I worked in retail selling electronics to people in Virginia who speak with an extra syllable in every word. I mean, shrimp instead of shrimp. Anyway, so I worked there for 2 years, and I learned a lot about Americans, America, and just cultural stuff and consumer behavior and about my colleagues. But one of the most shocking things that I learned was the poverty, because I thought, you know, in America, everybody drove a BMW and a Ferrari or Audis, but when I started working on retail, I realized that people were struggling to make ends meet on minimum wage. People were asking me, my colleagues asked me to loan them $10, $5 so they could have lunch. I thought, you know what, you're not supposed to be poor. You're not supposed to be poor in the world's richest country. And that's, most of the book hinges on the fact that how people struggle here and pay for childcare, you know, and healthcare and child support, mortgage, house, rent, all by a minimum wage job. They didn't have a choice. They just kept working one job, two jobs, three jobs. Mm-hmm. So the book is about how I saw things and how I had to swallow my pride and put on a pair of khakis and shirt and just get on the floor and start selling people stuff also get to know my colleagues and friends who work there. So that's what the book is about.
So this was your first book?
This is my second book.
Second book, okay. What was the first one about?
First book was about more of a humorous tone about me trying to figure out my life in the States, you know, figuring out cultural stuff in general, like driving on the wrong side of the road or
trying to
buy a sandwich at Subway and not knowing like four different kinds of cheeses and stuff, or walking in a locker room to go to a swimming pool with a room full of naked men, you know, not knowing just humorous stuff, more like Bill Rice and I'm a Stranger Here Myself kind of book.
Well, of course, what you saw America as being was from movies and TV, correct?
You're right.
Yeah, so this is why you had kind of a skewed vision of what America was.
Yeah. Right, I had a very different perception of vision of America before I came here, because the only thing I saw and learned about States was through the movies I saw in India.
Yeah. And of course that's true of your country, the people there. I was curious. You said that when you went back to visit, you couldn't tell your parents where you worked. Now, why was that?
Can you repeat the question? I'm losing you a little bit.
Oh, when you went back to visit India,
right?
You had
what
you,
was it like?
Well, you couldn't tell your parents about your work or anything about your job, and did you finally were you finally able to do that? To tell them about it?
I didn't. I mean, I told them about where I worked, but I didn't tell them what exactly I did. I didn't tell them that I was standing on my feet for 8 hours and just selling stuff to people on a daily basis and making very small amount of money. So I didn't tell them that, but I didn't tell them the whole, like, what the business was about and not fine details of the job.
Well, I would, from your book, I would have imagined that had they known all of the intricacies that you had to go through to become successful,
right,
they would have been very proud of you in that job, because you had to, you know, you had to figure out all the, of course, throw all the merchandise, but all the different kinds of people that came in and what they might want and so forth. I thought you did very well. It was a very interesting.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, if somebody told them exactly what I went through, I still don't have the heart to tell them that, but they would also cry, but also feel that, you know, I went through and I'm still here and I'm a stronger person than I was before.
Right.
I'm also a changed human being. You know, I have a lot of compassion for people who work in retail, and I have also a different perspective about how people live on such small amounts of money and are still able to put on a smile on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you in the U.S. before you wrote this book? How long had you lived?
I finished working there in 2006, and I started writing the book in 2011, five years after I quit the job. And so I had been here for 6 or 7 years when I started writing the book.
Did you become a manager of that that retail establishment, or
no? I did not. I was sales associate, salesperson the whole time.
Uh-huh. Well, the last few pages of your book, I thought maybe when that new guy came and he thought you're the man. So
yeah, the man. But I was the man in terms of how well I could sell, not because I was the manager.
Oh, I see. Well, I was interested in the approaches of the different people, in the store,
right,
the different, you know, the clerks, and especially that one who was dishonest. I thought, you know, that was
yeah,
and we see that all the time, of course, and
it happens all the time. But I was in a strange position to handle that.
Yes, but you handled it. You did exactly the right thing by telling Cindy.
I had to think about it, and I just wanted to do the right thing, no matter what the outcome was going to be.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see. How did you go about finding a publisher here?
When I finished the book, I started sending the query letter to all the various agents, like literary agents around the country, and I got a lot of rejections, several rejections, and finally one editor liked the book, and she read it, and she said she wanted to see the whole thing, and then she read the whole thing, and she said, okay, we want to publish it. But it took a while. I mean, it took at least 2-3 years before I found a publisher.
Okay. Well, I don't think that's unusual.
It isn't, but was it discouraging for you after everything you'd been through?
It was quite discouraging, but I didn't stop there, and I wrote another book. I kept writing more stuff, and I kept doing radio stuff for PRI's The World and other places. So I wasn't, just holding that book in my hand, and I wrote it, and I tried to get it published. I kept trying, but then the same time, I was also writing other stuff, and other things were getting published, like smaller stuff were getting published.
Did you ever think when you came to America that you would become a writer?
Well, I was writing for radio even when I was in India. And I came here, when you write for, when you make stories for radio, you have to write. So it's a different audience. It's on the audio, not the print. But and I had so many interesting stories to tell on the sales floor, and just being an immigrant in America. I mean, I have this inherent, you know, thing that everything hinges back on humor. If you may have noticed that in this book. So I just couldn't stop telling people, you know, about the stories, and I wanted to sit down and write. So I didn't know that I was going to become a writer, but this is who I am now.
I thought it was interesting when you went back to visit India, so many people wanted you to bring them to America. They wanted that was the last thing they said. Take me with you, right? Take me back. And why is that they want to come?
They said when I was in India, they thought, I was foolish to think even I want to return and live in India. It's come on, no. Half the India is lining up at the outside the U.S. embassy for a visa. You want to quit everything, come back?
Yeah.
So, Deepak, where do you live now?
I live in Maine, Brunswick.
Wow.
So I assume that Holly finished her, got her PhD?
Yeah, she got a PhD, and I've been traveling or living in different places with her. She taught at University of Michigan and Notre Dame and Ohio, and now at Maine, Bowdoin College, if you've heard of it.
Wow. Yes. I also found it interesting that you got married in India, and then she came back to the States, and you then came afterwards. But it was very different. Your relationship started out very differently here than what it had been like in India, didn't it?
Yes, it's if you go to a different country and marry a guy or a woman from that culture in that country, and you live there for a while, and then you move to the spouse's country, and all of a sudden you see the same person in a different light, in a different context.
And
that was a bit of it took a bit of getting used to.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing Holly in a different culture with her friends, who are also Americans and anthropologists, and the things that she talked about and an environment it takes a while to know that, okay, this is the same person you knew in India, but all of a sudden she's acting different, she talks different, she talks about different things, and did you really make the right decision, or was it a big mistake, And I couldn't really talk about my feelings with anybody because it was my decision, and I could not have shared this with my parents because they would not have known what I was talking about because they had only seen Holly in India. So,
right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so it was difficult in the beginning, but Holly was a very sensible, she's a very intelligent woman, and so if she was also having a hard time with me because I was not happy in the beginning, and she didn't know what to do to make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
So, he talked a lot, and things got better slowly. We're still together.
Good. That's
well,
good.
One thing that really complicated, I'm sure, is that the living situation, you were living with a group of her friends.
Right.
Instead of just the two of you. That must have been challenging.
That was the part of the problem, because if we had been living together from the very first day, it would have been okay. But she was with her friends who were mostly ladies and women, and she had a different kind of relationship with them. They didn't know anything about who this guy was, and all of a sudden I was in that house. And
right.
So they couldn't adjust to me. I had to adjust to them, and I didn't know what to do to adjust or be American all of a sudden or talk about things that they knew. I mean, I didn't grow up watching the same TV shows, the same cartoons, the same books. There was definitely a gap between the culture, It was it takes a while. I've been living here for 13, 14 years now, so I know enough of this culture to be able to strike a conversation or be part of a conversation. But it was hard when you were just one day new, just arrived, fresh off the plane. So, yeah.
So you had, when you got here, you couldn't immediately start to work. You had to get a work permit. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, I also didn't know this. I thought you get the visa, you also can work. But that was not true. So I had to apply for a work permit. That took 3 months. And those 3 months, most of my money that I brought was gone. And I was very lonely and bored and frustrated because, as you know, I had a good job back in India. I was very free. I had freedom to do what I wanted. And all of a sudden, I was confined to a single room and no friends, and just Holly, who was studying all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was had become a sort of a, prison.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now,
you're limited to a room and no friends and no money. You cannot go and you don't know how to drive. You can't work. You don't have places. Your familiar friends you can go and hang out and talk about. Phone calls are very expensive back to India, and they're much cheaper with Skype and Facebook and on whatnot these days. but not then. Right. So it was, it changes you. Some hard, you go through hard stuff and you learn, you re-examine your own life, your own self and who you are, and it's just, a different kind of patch in your life which teaches you different things.
Well, in this job that you had in the electronics store, you certainly grew. I mean, your personality grew. You grew as a man. You grew as a person, and because you had to interact with not only your fellow workers, but also all these people that came into the store. And as you know, everybody has a story. And I was intrigued by the way you approached people, tried to approach them on a personal level. And not selling them right away, but just, and I thought that was good.
You know, I've heard a lot about these story in America when they teach their kids, you know, babies to swim. They throw the baby in the water.
Yeah,
it's very difficult for the baby in the beginning, but you know that's how he learns to swim and he becomes a strong swimmer. So me, I was thrown onto a sales floor. It was rough. I was not enjoying, mm-hmm. but I'm really, really happy now that I did that. You know, people came to me so I could talk. I didn't have to stop anybody on the street to have a conversation. People came to me looking for some things, and I was able to talk to them.
Right.
And slowly I got to know them on a personal level. I told them my story. Sometimes they told me their very personal stuff. And sometimes it was good, sometimes it was hard. But then you're right. I've learned a lot. I've changed. I have a different perception about people who work in retail or people who work in service. So anywhere, even in India or America, all kinds of people, all shades of people. So that was very, very, interesting training for me.
Well, one thing I took away from this is how, you know, this is a low-wage job, and yet it requires a lot of intelligence and an ability to learn.
And knowledge of the
product,
my gosh.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, most people think you can walk into a electronics store, say a big chain, and think, you know, this guy works here who would help you. But there's also, you keep in mind that how much training that person goes for to be able to explain you about a certain product of cell phone or iPod or whatever. So, you know, I had a very condescending kind of attitude when I went into that job. I thought, why do I have to do this? This is beneath me. Well, I don't even want this. But soon I realized, look, you know what? If I want to or even are able to keep this job, I will have to learn how to do this job.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned it from my manager. She was so good, and I just watched her, listened to her, mimicked her pitches. And every single product required a different kind of information. And every customer is different, you know. Sometimes you're dealing with an 8-year-old lady. Sometimes you're dealing with a 20-year-old woman, you know, in a bad relationship with a man. So,
yeah. Do you know what happened to... Do you know what happened to your coworker, Ron, that was in financial difficulty and had to quit? Did you ever follow up?
I don't know what happened, but I hope he's okay. He's doing well. I mean, wages have gone up since then. It was only $5, $6 an hour back then, but it's much more now. And
uh-huh.
I mean, I hope he has become manager or done well somewhere else. I'm not in touch with any of the folks in the store.
Okay. Well, you know, I was interested, too, in the fact that your mother was very surprised that you did the dishes at your house.
Yeah.
Well, that's a difference in culture. I mean, you know, it's like you said, in India, if you can possibly afford a maid, you have a maid. And and here, you know, that just isn't the case at all. Might like to have a maid, but we don't have one.
It's also a part of a cultural, like, a status symbol in India. Like, if you cannot afford it, you try everything to be able to afford a maid, even though probably you might not need one.
Uh-huh.
Dishes by yourself, it's not a big deal. I know now. I would, if I went back to India, I would never have a maid. I know how to wash dishes.
<You
know? laughs> So in India, my mother thought not only that it was hard for me to wash dishes with my hands, but also that I had to do such things is so horrible. You know, but it wasn't. I mean, I quite enjoy washing dishes. It's kind of an interesting time when I think about stories.
You know, I think that the attitude that there's nothing that is beneath you is
right.
Really key to success.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, that's called work ethic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So, Deepak, what?
Very important, yeah.
Deepak, would you like to read a little bit from the book so that the listeners can get a feel for your great storytelling?
Yeah, I'm going to read from a book, a chapter called Transit. I'm describing here as I am packing stuff to come to America. You can tell me when to stop. You said 5 minutes is okay?
Yes.
Okay. It was my first international journey. As I packed my suitcase, I kept noticing new items in it. My mother was rearranging it every few hours, adding a jar of her homemade mango pickle or a box filled with medicines in case I got a headache, flu, or indigestion. I noticed there was a couple of tubes of toothpaste and a few bars of soap. I didn't question her, but it seemed as if she was thinking I might return before the soap or toothpaste ran out. Sad. I didn't want to make her sad by reminding her that I was traveling on a one-way ticket. Mm. My father bought me thermal underwear and said, never step out of the house without wrapping up well. He shoved a wad of cash in my shirt pocket. He looked away and he said, I know this is not much, but this is all I have right now. He didn't want to show me his wet eyes. With a heavy heart, I left my home in Lucknow. I cleared all the formalities at the airport in New Delhi. As I sat waiting at the gate, the various events that had led to this day dawned on me. I was actually moving to the United States. As I write this, I wonder what I, the Deepak, who has lived in the States for more than a decade, would say to the Deepak that was waiting at the New Delhi airport to come to America for the first time. I would not discourage him from coming to the United States, but I would tell him the realistic picture. The America he's going to see in person is very different from the America he has seen in Hollywood movies in India. Yes, even janitors own a car in the United States, not because they can afford one, but because they cannot afford to not own one. Yes, Indians are among the most successful immigrants in the United States, but not all Indians or all immigrants in general own motels and businesses and become doctors. There are Indians who mop the floors and clean the toilets and struggle to pay their rent. America has the world's best health system, but it's not available to everyone. I would also tell him, myself, to leave behind my ego, arrogance, or privilege that he might have had in India. Soon, I heard the announcement. It was time to board the plane. As soon as I stepped on the plane, it seemed as though I were really in a foreign land. The smiling, all-white aircraft crew greeted everyone in German-accented English. Very few people looked like me. The thought that this giant metal box was going to fly in a few minutes and made me nervous, more than a little unsure. A part of me wanted to get off and take the next train back to Lucknow. It was about 10 at night. I settled in the seat and thought of my parents. My father would probably be in bed, but my mother and brother would still be watching TV for a while before they slept. They also ate their dinner late. My brother controlled the remote, and my mother watched what he wanted to watch, which was usually a cricket match. If I had been sitting next to them, I'd have been watching the same thing, slapping his knee or shouting at the screen. Everyone in my family except my father could watch cricket any time of the day. Mm-hmm. I found the menu in the back pocket of the airplane seat. Among the many choices, I could recognize only one item, samosa. Soon, the aircraft took off. Out of my window, I saw the twinkling lights of New Delhi fading away from me as the plane soared. Slowly, everything turned into darkness, as if India were turning off its lights for the night, saying goodbye to me. I rested my head on the window, straining my eyes to see the last glimmer, and then faded to sleep. The next time I opened my eyes, the captain was telling us we were descending into Vienna. Should I keep going? Or?
Yeah, that's a good place to stop. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And if you're just tuning in, this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're speaking today with Deepak Singh, author of How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. And back again. You don't get into that in this story, but you didn't remain a minimum wage employee.
No.
Do you feel like the American dream has come true for you?
It is. I mean, the book seems like it is a sad story, a downward mobility, but it's also a success story because I did become one of the top salesmen in the store and in several other stores around the city. And I gained a different kind of knowledge, became a different person, and and now I'm doing what I did before. I'm making radio stories, and I'm writing. I'm a full-time writer. This is my second book. I don't think I would have become a writer living in India, because America lets you be who you want to be.
Oh, that's an interesting. That's good. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I was interested that the part about where you called in sick one day, and so then they were so your coworkers were ready to sue the restaurant where you thought, you know, but she said everybody's so anxious to sue, and you notice so many caution signs around the mall, and that's true. I hadn't thought about that, but that's absolutely true. Yeah,
right.
So where is your book available?
It's available everywhere, in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and stores, University of California website.
And when did it come out? When was it published?
February 14th, 2017.
Okay, so it's been a few months. And have you gotten a pretty good response so far?
I've gotten reviews from Kirkus Reviews, a good review, and Booklist, good review. And I've also been featured in Atlantic magazine, the Atlantic, and yeah, I mean, the people are posting good reviews on Amazon and Goodreads, so I'm guessing people are liking it.
Well, I don't know how much influence we have, but I recommend this book highly.
It's really interesting to read.
It is.
Yeah, it definitely
it's
is.
I couldn't really put it down. I wanted to see what happened the next chapter.
Thank you. It's a big compliment. Thank you so much.
And Deepak, are you working on another book now?
I'm working on another book. Can I quickly share with you what it is about?
Sure.
So, right after quitting that job, I went to India for a year because my wife was doing her field research in my hometown. And when I was there for a year, my father asked me to build a house for him. So he had just retired, and he had gotten about $30,000 and something like that in retirement fund. And he said, "Hey, you know, I have the money, and you don't have a job. So how about you build a house for us?" So basically, what he wanted me to, be the contractor, you know, the guy who arranges plumbers, electricians, bricklayers, and all the stuff for the house. And so I built a house in 9 months, and it was a reverse culture shock on steroids. I'd gone from driving an Oldsmobile in Virginia to driving a 100cc motorbike and building a house. That book is about...
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, you have a lot of talents, and that's good.
And a lot of courage.
Now I've managed to build a house. It's not fallen yet.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, Deepak, thank you so much for joining us today on Writers' Voices.
Thank you, Monica and Caroline.
Pleasure to have you.
Caroline.
Yeah. Caroline, thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to take a little musical break now, and we'll be back with our second guest. All right. We're back. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I am still Monica Hadley, and with me is still Caroline Kilborn.
On a beautiful day in June.
2017, if you happen to be listening to this as a podcast at some future date. And Caroline, why don't you introduce our next guest?
This guest is Mugambi, is that it? Mugambi Jue, and he teaches at Stanford Law School. His writing has been featured in Mother Jones, State, The New Republic, San Francisco Chronicle, Huffington Post, Salon, The Hill, Liberation, Le Monde, and academic journals. He has traveled extensively within America and internationally, and this book is very interesting.
And the title is Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other by Mugambi Jue. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mugambi.
Thank you so much.
So tell us how you came to write this particular book.
I was trying to answer three fundamental questions. How did America go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump? Why America is so intensely polarized? And how is it explained by American exceptionalism?
Which brings us to, of course, the key question. What is American exceptionalism?
Most people today think that American exceptionalism means a faith in American superiority. Exceptionalism as exceptional, meaning outstanding, phenomenal, or superior, but that is not what American exceptionalism has primarily meant historically. It's primarily been a descriptive concept, especially compared to other Western nations, that America being an exception. For example, America is the only Western democracy today to still have the death penalty and the only one to lack a universal health care system. And these are dimensions of what American exceptionalism has historically meant. And they're not inherently good or bad. It depends on what you think of the death penalty and universal health care. And what I argue in my book is that the extraordinary polarization of modern American society is a dimension of what American exceptionalism truly means, because Americans are routinely clashing over a broad range of issues that are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the Western world.
Well, I think we've all seen how that's played out in the last few decades, at least. And I think, you know, we tend to have a tendency to think that at some time in the past, Americans were all more on the same page about things, that we all were in agreement about things. But if you look at history, that's not really the case, is it?
There were periods of greater or lesser polarization in American history. So it's true that there were times when people were in greater agreement about, say, economic issues. After Franklin Roosevelt introduced the New Deal model, it became very popular with both Democrats and Republicans, and there was greater consensus that the government had the responsibility to provide for the basic economic well-being of the American people. That being said, that started to shift more or less in the 1980s due to a number of different factors, and the polarization of American society today under Donald Trump is not new. America also was very polarized under the presidencies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, for example.
Well, I think even, you know, we may look back and think that there was a lot of agreement around FDR, but I happen to have an old family scrapbook full of articles denouncing FDR for those very things. So
everybody agreed with FDR, and also were clashes over a broad range of issues in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. But it's still worth noting that, say, Dwight Eisenhower, who was a Republican president, of course, did not have a fundamental quarrel with many of the big-picture ideas of the New Deal, of the government mm-hmm. having a duty to provide for the basic economic well-being of the American people. And in fact, the top income tax rate under Eisenhower was approximately 90%, whereas under Obama, the highest it got in terms of income taxes was 39%. So there was much greater consensus on some economic issues in the age of Eisenhower or even Nixon, for example, than later years.
So you feel the polarization is worse now than it was during those time periods?
That is supported by empirical data. As I describe in my book, political scientists have found that the degree of partisan polarization in Congress during the Obama years reached its highest level since the Reconstruction era following the Civil War. And we see that during the Trump presidency, there's an intensification in different ways of polarization, very significant clashes about what the country should do and how to resolve its problems, and also a rhetoric used by Mr. Trump, which his supporters find admirable and that many other citizens find extremely troubling.
There seems to be a huge acceptance of political leaders now, and you know, I'm referring to Mr. Trump in particular, feeling free to lie and say things that are totally untrue. But there's one section in your book where you quote a number of different politicians and who are saying things that just really aren't true at all. And they're not a matter of opinion. They're objectively untrue. Is this new, or has this always happened at different periods in history?
Propaganda is probably as old as the history of the world, and it's played a big role in European history and in American history as well. That being said, the magnitude of conspiracy theories and blatant falsehoods today in America is really extraordinary by international standards. Claims like climate change being a hoax have much less influence in modern Europe than in America, and incidentally, they've played a big role in Donald Trump's decision to step away from the Paris Accord on climate change. When he was on the campaign trail, Donald Trump claimed that climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese, but we see, and as I describe in my book, that this type of rhetoric was very common well before Donald Trump came onto the picture. Many leaders of the Republican establishment have advanced similar ideas about climate change being a myth, or blatantly false claims about other issues, say universal health care or the tyranny of socialized medicine, which played a big role in rousing people against Obama's healthcare reform. Now, of course, people can have different views about whether healthcare reform was a good idea and how the program was put in place, but what's striking is the influence of blatantly false claims in shaping the debate.
I know. It was so amazing to me that, you know, everyone that I know who's on Medicare thinks it's pretty darn good, and it is socialized medicine, basically. So why, I don't see how they bought into this idea that expanding that to other people would be so terrible that it, you know, it's...
a form of cognitive dissonance. Indeed, Medicare tends to be a popular program among many citizens, and many would be very much opposed to losing Medicare access. That being said, many of these same citizens are very wary of quote-unquote big government and of expanding access to health care to the rest of the people. And that's partly due to the notion that America simply cannot afford Medicare for all or universal health care because it would be far too expensive. And it's true that in America, the costs of health care is extremely high. That's partly because there are no pricing regulations like in other Western nations. And we see that actually other Western nations, that is, European countries, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, as well as other developed countries like Japan, spend much less than America on healthcare while covering everyone. And that's because healthcare is seen primarily as a public service and a human right, not as a for-profit business in America.
Well, I've always found it interesting that insurance, health insurance, actually started out as a nonprofit, kind of everybody pitching in together to help people who are having trouble, but then it really wasn't. I did a little research once, and it really wasn't until the 70s that most of the insurance companies started converting to being for profit, and that seems to be the root of a lot of the problem.
It's not only health insurance companies, but also the wider medical industry, from hospitals to pharmaceutical drugs,
right,
are generally treated as for-profit.
Yeah. I mean, the hospitals all used to be church-related, years ago,
yeah,
or most of them, or church or state. And we do still have some really good state-sponsored hospitals, like University of Iowa, mm-hmm, Hospital, and still some very good Catholic hospitals, too. But there are a lot more that are private and for-profit now. Mugambi, one of the things you have a section in the book where you talk about why people vote against their own economic interest. And in that you say that it's, not just, working class people who vote against their own economic interest by voting for politicians who want to give big tax cuts to the wealthy and cut services, but that a fairly large proportion of the wealthy, in a sense, vote against their economic interest because they're siding with the raising of taxes and providing more services. But I wanted to argue a point with that. I actually think that an enlightened wealthy person knows that spreading prosperity will benefit them in the long run. So they aren't voting against their own interest.
Yes, it depends how we construe voting against one's self-interest. As you mentioned, and as I explained in the book, there are many citizens who are well-to-do, who favor policies that would raise their own taxes and that would reduce wealth inequality for the rest of the country. They're also in favor of policies that would ensure access to abortion or gay rights, which may help explain why they tend to vote Democrat. But of course, looking at the big picture, it may also be in their own economic interest to favor more socioeconomic equality. And as I explained before, with universal health care, actually other Western nations spend much less than the U.S. does, so there's a way to favor broader equality in a way that also helps even privileged people.
Well, that is true. And, I'm primarily a business person, and for me, I know that if the bulk of our people are living hand-to-mouth and don't have resources, they're not going to be able to buy my products or services. And that in order for an economy to grow, everybody has to benefit, not just those at the top.
Yes, that is the attitude in many other Western nations. But in the U.S., even when people agree about this, there's also a major clash over how to achieve greater economic growth. So usually Republicans tend to think that the best way to do so is to eviscerate the role of government over the U.S. economy, slash taxes, slash regulations, get rid of, Obamacare and other efforts to help people who may be struggling, whereas Democrats tend to think that the best way to achieve prosperity is for the government to play a role in leveling the playing field and in providing meaningful social service programs, because if you are beset by profound medical problems or with exorbitant medical bills, well, you can't fulfill your individual life goals or even the American dream.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're speaking with Mugambi Jewett, author of Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. I want to talk a little bit about one of the issues that seems to be very close to your heart, which has to do with criminal justice, because you were a defense lawyer for indigent people. And So tell us a little bit about how you came to do that work and what you've learned from it and what you would like, what message you would like to convey about that.
Right out of law school, I became a public defender, that is, a human rights lawyer defending poor people in criminal court. I was working in Manhattan. I also had a chance to do some work in other parts of the country. And it's really important to understand that today America has mass incarceration on a scale not only unprecedented in American history, but virtually unprecedented in the history of humankind. There are over 2 million people behind bars in America, and also the incarceration rate, it's important to understand, is relative to the size of the population. So America incarcerates 5 to 10 times as many people as a percentage of its population than other Western democracies. And that's a good benchmark to evaluate the state of modern American society, because as various thinkers have suggested throughout history, one can really judge a society by entering its prisons. If a society can recognize that even people accused of serious crimes have fundamental human rights, have fundamental human dignity, then that's a good benchmark for where society should be in terms of not dehumanizing its members. And we see that there are trends historically with the surge in wealth inequality at the same time as a surge in mass incarceration, and they are part of the picture here as well.
Would you say for-profit prisons are part of the problem?
It's hard to tell to what extent they are part of the mass incarceration phenomenon, but they are certainly part of the equation in some level. But there are many prisons that are not-for-profit that still have a lot of prisoners, so I would not say that this is the main cause.
Was there a point in our history where you can see where we started going down this path towards mass incarceration? Because it almost seems contradictory to our idea of ourselves as the land of the free, and which would sort of imply maybe fewer laws and fewer people being incarcerated than other countries. Where do you see this trend having begun?
Until the 1970s or so, America had incarceration levels that were relatively comparable to other Western democracies, and then the U.S. prison population skyrocketed. And that was due to a number of different factors, including the surge in wealth inequality and the harshening of social attitudes. There was also a surge in crime in the 60s in particular. But most experts trace mass incarceration not to crime levels itself, but to different ways of thinking about crime. In my book, I look at different parts of the picture, such as the role of race discrimination, the role of class discrimination, the weight of anti-intellectualism in shaping very counterproductive policies, the role of Christian fundamentalism in shaping harsher attitudes towards prisoners as well, and also America's refusal in many ways to adhere to international human rights standards in this area.
You know, it's interesting that Christian fundamentalism would make harsher treatment of prisoners, because the Bible is full of things telling you to be kind to prisoners and to visit people in prison. And you know, that was one of the things Jesus taught. So it's sort of backwards.
There have always been very different conceptions and interpretations of the Bible throughout history, and they also have played a big role in America. So today, America is divided between, on one hand, Christian fundamentalists, who are very hardline in their conception of Christianity, and liberal or moderate Christians, who have much more
compassion,
liberal positions on these issues, from mass incarceration to social policy as a whole. So it's many Christian Americans have been focused on supporting criminal justice reform, and that's also to be remembered as we talk about the views of those who have reservations about compassion towards people in prison. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Mugambe Jue, author of Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. One of the things that I found interesting was, you know, the term exception, American exceptionalism, and how that was first used, and it wasn't what most people think. It was by the leader of the U.S. Communist Party.
Yes, most scholars trace the origins of the phrase American exceptionalism to American communists who used the phrase in the early 20th century to argue that the so-called universal laws of Marxism would have to evolve differently because America was an exception, that it had different social and economic conditions. So it did not mean that America is inherently superior. And the phrase American exceptionalism then started being used mostly by academics afterwards who analyzed different unique dimensions of American history, law, culture, etc. And it was not before the Obama presidency that American exceptionalism became widely used in the U.S. Political debate, and that's because leaders of the Republican establishment started routinely accusing Obama of not believing in American exceptionalism and aiming to transform America into Europe, or at best Canada, with his un-American and socialist agenda. And they equated American exceptionalism with a faith in American superiority that Obama allegedly did not have.
Now, Mugambe, you were born in France, is that correct?
No, unlike Barack Obama, I was actually born in Kenya.
Okay, you were born in Kenya and raised in Paris.
Yes, my father is Kenyan and my mother is French.
And you came to the United States to go to college, is that correct?
Yes.
And so you've been here a number of years. You now are a professor at Stanford Law. Did you have any hesitation about writing this book that some people might see as critical of America, although I don't see it that way. I do want to say that I see it as just giving some historical and a lot of new kind of numerical perspective, a lot of sign of looking at what's really happening, the numbers and the studies and so forth, to some of these issues that we have. And I don't think that examining an issue is necessarily a criticism of the country. But there are people who do. And so did you have any hesitation about, you know, people about putting yourself out there as a critic as an immigrant and being a target because of that?
My goal in this book was not to criticize America, but to analyze it and to help understand it. And as I describe, there are many different dimensions of American exceptionalism, some positive ones and some more troubling ones. And I underline that America has made countless contributions to human progress, to the development of democracy and human rights throughout the world, to science, to the arts, to literature, and that many American thinkers have been also models for other countries, from the Founding Fathers to Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, and beyond. And that's what's also interesting. For many foreigners, America is often a model of both what to do and what not to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, Mugambe, let's talk a little bit about like how long you spent on this book. It seems very timely because there's a lot of references, of course, to the Obama presidency and also to the Trump presidency. So it seems like you must have written it fairly recently. How long did you work on this?
I started writing the book well before Donald Trump's election. I was trying to make sense of the polarization of American society during the Obama years. And I was seeing the rise of figures like Sarah Palin, of the Tea Party movement, and ultimately of Donald Trump as part of a much broader phenomenon over several decades that itself could be traced to the roots of American exceptionalism, unique dimensions of its history, culture, politics, race relations, religious beliefs, economic attitudes, foreign policy, etc.
So, did you have a publisher, like before it was even finished, did you have a publisher lined up? Because getting something that's this timely and to print this quickly is not easy to do.
Yes, I had the University of California Press several months before the U.S. Presidential election. And, of course, we talked about making updates with regard to the outcome of the election before the book went to press.
And is this your first published book, or have you published others?
It's my first one.
Wow. And is it going to be your only, or is it the first of many?
I hope it's the first of many.
What other things would you like to write books about?
There are many different dimensions of American society that I find highly fascinating. So this is going to give me a lot of room for thought in the future, and also would want to look at whether there are unique dimensions of French society that are worth comparing, and more closely the relationship between America and France, because both countries are nations born of the Enlightenment and of universal ideals of liberty. The founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, actually were ambassadors to France. And what's striking is that they mingled in the circles of the French Enlightenment. And the countries, therefore, have really common roots, and they have been mutual influences. And that has been forgotten. That's going to be a part of my next project.
Ah, that sounds very interesting. I'd love to take a look at that when you finish. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Mugambi. And I want to give the title once more, Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. A lot of good information here, a lot of studies, a lot of statistics. It's a heavily footnoted book. Even the footnotes are interesting. And so, Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
I do. You know, a lie is as powerful as the truth if you can get someone to believe it.
That is unfortunately true.
Yep.
Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. If you're listening on Friday, if you're listening on our rebroadcast Monday morning, have a great week and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUU-FM.com and writersvoices.com.